Good morning, everyone. I'm Meredith Brooks. I'm chairing today's session, this morning's session, which is going to be presented by Sean McGing and Andrew Mead of Ernst & Young, Melbourne and Sydney, reps, respectively. They're talking about superannuation and innovation in superannuation, and almost a bit of a contrast to our plenary session, this is a bit more of a manufacturer's viewpoint. So this is about what funds themselves need to do to deliver the right sort of outcomes for investors. So it's very much a supply side part of the equation rather than the demand side of earlier this morning. Sean and I'm going to go through both your bios. I'm sure people probably know who you are better. Sean actually doesn't say that he's Irish, but he obviously is. So adjust your interpretation accordingly. But he's been in Australia, obviously, for about 20 years or so. That sounds about right. Looking at the bio, Ernst & Young in Melbourne, very much a background in superannuation and looking very much at the platform operational side, from what I can see, in terms of his consulting background. Andrew is also at Ernst & Young, this time in Melbourne, in Sydney, and is also very heavily involved in the Institute and has a product background too. So the way we're going to play this is Sean is going to present on innovation and superannuation. Then he and Andrew are going to do a double act in terms of Q&A. So unlike the previous session, we're not SMSing Q&A because we don't really have the facilities up here. There'll be a microphone down on the front desk here. So please just wave and we'll send down the mic to you. Okay, over to Sean. Thank you.
Thank you. I've got to be careful not to spoil the whole thing by falling off the back of the stage here. Innovation in superannuation and more. I would have thought most of us have a belly full of it already, but of course it's going to be more and more as we go forward, and this morning's intro by Mr. Salt on the demographics make that very, very clear. No, you're not in the wrong room, but there's a lot of what we're going to say this morning which relates to those inquiries. They are going to have an enormous impact going forward. So hopefully now you're alert, but not alarmed. So what will we cover? Well, we'll define innovation, and we'll consider why we should innovate. We'll try and imagine what innovated super might look like in all its bells and whistles, its ideal. But we've got a limited, we've only got half an hour, I think, to speak, so well, we'll have to sort of hold back on that a bit. And then we'll narrow the field down and look at these three areas. Definition. Now, at the previous Financial Services Forum 2 years ago, Rachel Fu and I wrote a paper on back office innovation. And in that, we defined innovation as a radical or incremental change in thinking, products, processes, or organizations. And a critical part of innovation, recognizing innovation, is what the goal is, and that is positive change to make something better. Now, we did conclude in that paper that there had been a lot of innovation in the back office over the last 10 years or so. And some of those themes come through in the various government reports and will come through further in our paper this morning. Being a bunch of actuaries, we thought, well, let's look at this from the actuarial perspective and let's look at what equity is about in this whole business of superannuation. So we've defined equitable innovation as innovation that requires improved outcomes over time in aggregate for all stakeholders, but specifically must include improvements for Superfund members relative to the positions they would have been in had the improvement not occurred, had the innovation not occurred. So this is similar in theme and spirit to the test that a life company director would make when he or she is looking at distributing profits and the fairness of those profits between policyholders and shareholders, allowing for things like expenses that all have to happen in the background, and also the equivalence test in a successor fund transfer. So let's bear that equitable concept in mind as we go through. Now, the key to remember here is that innovation is not necessarily just a single game-changing event. It can be quite incremental over time. An example might be the whole concept of platforms, you know, which now dominate the retail industry. 80% of contributions are received that way. You know, that didn't happen overnight. It was over a long time. So why innovate? And ultimately, it's all about improving members' position in retirement. Now, in the 2008 Back Office Innovations paper I referred to earlier, Rachel Fu and myself identified six key requirements, and they're listed there. I mean, most of them are pretty obvious, but when you sit down and actually think about them and draw them out, they're the elements we should be looking for when assessing if something is innovative or not, or in trying to improve things going forward. The first five apply directly to members, and the third one applies indirectly, because the more competitive the landscape, the more likely that is to drive innovation. So they're the elements by which we measure innovation, so all those improvements in various areas. But what actually drives those? Competition, I've already mentioned. The other key one that we really see right at the moment is the extent of legislation and regulatory involvement. And interesting, listening to the discussion in the previous hour around the trust in the system, the regulatory environment is absolutely critical for that, and we should encourage that. We still want choice, so that the optimal outcomes can occur, but that legislation and regulation is absolutely critical. And tax, of course, has always been a key driver in consumer behaviours, perhaps much more than it should be in theory, but that's the reality. And again, going back to the animal spirits of people, if there's something that you can get from the tax man, then that's what people are inclined to do. So we're not going to change that overnight. Technology, huge driver, consumer protection, some specialization perhaps around outsourcing, around administrators. 30 years ago, those people didn't exist. And of course, product development, and we'll touch on a few of those as we go through. The dream. Look after your life, we look after your super. So meeting retirement needs of members is not about technical things. It's about lifestyle. And the financial planning industry is better at recognizing that than most of us. Some of us have been responsible for putting these sorts of themes together. But it is that dream, and it's got to be right for the member. Now, let's imagine what innovated super might look like. Best returns, best income, best service, full access, total trust. Again, a theme from this morning. Ideally, if money could grow on trees, or if we could find the geese that lay the golden eggs, that would be wonderful. That would take part of the dollar side. Then there's the service side, or how easy it is, or how comfortable one feels with the whole process. Is the member in control? Are they sufficiently trusting that when they perhaps go to withdraw money from the ATM, from their retirement account, that they get some warning that, hey, don't do this every day, you're going to use up all the money you have, or, you know, this is the position before, this is the position after, in easily communicable terms. Now, there are challenges that we have, but ideally, if we live the dream, then they're the sorts of service elements that should be taken for granted going forward. It's got to be easy, too. And just examples where some of those things are actually starting to happen right now. You know, there is ones... software administrator who is developing iPhone applications for balances. So they're the sorts of things that are happening. Now, we know that a lot of those are happening in other industries. So our challenge is, within the industry, to ourselves, is it as the Australian movie The Castle claims, you know, you're dreaming, or is this something we can actually achieve? So moving on to the structure, the operational efficiency, and the post-retirement incomes, there's three examples of areas. And looking back at innovation in each of those in turn and looking forward as well, starting with Superfund structure. The structure we have in Australia is essentially a three-pillar one. We've got the age-based pension, we've got the SGC, the mandatory contributions, and we also have a third pillar of voluntary contributions. And collectively, that is recognised as, you know, among the best in the world. So the Mercer Melbourne Global Pension Index rated at number 2. Fourth, an adequacy, which is having enough for people to retire on ultimately. Second, in sustainability, in terms of the structures that are there, the volume of contributions likely to stay going forward. Those elements, second in the world. And integrity, which is around the trust and the private sector involvement in the governance of the whole system. At the detail level, right across asset managers, custodians, superannuation funds, etc. You know, that's number one. So we really have a pretty good system to deal with, and that's the conclusion that Cooper has drawn as well. The main driver in the past has been legislation and regulation. And examples of those in some people's minds would be, for instance, the way APRA has actually approached regulation, being very thorough around principles-based, actually doing reviews, being quite tough on getting the message across to trustees of superannuation funds around the responsibilities that they have and being thorough and professional in the processes they go around them. That got us through the GFC in much, much better than most other people around the world, where the regulators didn't actually do the things they were saying they should do, or they weren't cohesive enough across the various elements of the industry. So that really is an innovation in many people's minds. Another one would be the licensing requirements, which have forced smaller funds to merge, the small APRA funds. That gives scale, that leads to efficiencies, another innovation. I've listed several of them here. The awards is obviously the critical one. There's insurance. Look at the increase of coverage of members, particularly in industry funds where people didn't have much coverage before. And those things are they're getting more choice, they're getting more options, and they're actually being covered. So the amount of coverage is improving all the time. Co-contributions and spouse contributions, very, very equitable in terms of aiming those funds at the less fortunate in our society. SMSFs, a third of the total assets under management in the industry are in SMSFs. So it must be a good idea. It must be meeting needs. Now, that's part of the industry that is, you know, largely away from the retail funds and away from the industry funds. But that's grown from 5% and around the $10 million mark 15, 16 years ago to $400 billion now and 35% of the industry. So something good must be coming there. And I'd say that some of the elements there of innovation are around investment choices and obviously the control side of things. I'll skip on to the final one there. The defined benefit to defined contribution, I think, is an innovation perhaps from the employer's perspective because of the transfer of risk to the member. But if we look at our definition of equitable innovation, you know, I challenge us to look on that as, is that equitable at the end of the day or not? And I suspect not. I mean, it's a lot more complicated than that, obviously, but I'll put that thought out there for you. In terms of going forward, we have the reviews. They'll be covered elsewhere, but the MySuper, the SuperStream proposals actually set out quite a lot of detail to be picked up and run with going forward. The Henry Review on retirement incomes, again, is encouraging. Further work and further government support around longevity, availability of appropriate assets, etc., going forward. How will the industry benefit from innovation in the structure sense? I think a key one is the encouragement to pay lump sums rather than income. Now, the whole concept of double dipping, if you like, is draining the tax base. Some people are gaining more from that than others. Question, can we do anything to prevent that, to change it? Management of longevity risk, aging population, as Bernard Salt was talking about this morning, huge opportunities there. Integration with Social Security, lots of opportunity to get that mix right and get the relative tax balances in those areas right too. Financial advice. Members do need some level of advice generally, and it doesn't have to be complicated. It can be quite light, as I describe it here, or limited. But the first little piece of advice is the most valuable one, and it might be very basic around budgeting. I think it was Richard Cornell at one of these forums in the past did an excellent paper looking at advice. And there were the sorts of conclusions that were drawn from that. But that's needed, but we need to find ways to make it cost-effective and relevant. Corporate-defined benefit schemes. Should we have some sort of insurance arrangement? Should we have some safety net there? I've just come back from spending 3 weeks in Ireland, and that was very illuminating in lots of ways. They've just gone through a 12%, 11.7 to be exact, decrease in GNP over the last 12 months. They have suffered a 20% decrease in house prices the last year, and that's on top of the 10 or so the year before. What was interesting from a superannuation scheme perspective was that the people that had jobs were being challenged to reduce the terms, lighten the terms of their schemes, or they would not have a job, the company would go. So, you know, when push comes to shove and things get serious, that's when you need safety nets and other schemes. So the theory and the practice are quite different at those points. Operational efficiency. Have a read of that list there. Most of you will be familiar with it. Just a comment perhaps around the IT&T, information technology and telecommunications. Really, there's been limited innovation to date compared to what could be possible. We'll touch on that in just a minute. Another one perhaps worth thinking about is the platform side, where you've got very extensive service capabilities, reporting, but the multiple levels of fees along the way and the ticket clipping, not necessarily always equitable. Future innovation. In operational efficiency, there's probably more scope here, but than anywhere else, but it's very incremental. It's bits and pieces. Now, the SuperStream proposals have some very fundamental recommendations, and they're around standardization of data formats. I mean, these are the building blocks of administration, and it's the devil is in the detail on these things. You know, it's like the internet. If you've got one or two on it, well, it's not great. But if everybody is on it, everybody benefits, and people get the benefits, communicate, and everybody's better off. Standard definitions in forms, perhaps some element of forcing. So Superstream, for instance, has forcing employers to actually provide electronic data with contributions, perhaps fine them if they don't, in order to get everyone on the same page and not, you know, this company developing this. And there are a number of initiatives across the industry trying to get there, but it's those elements, you know, mass transaction processing, electronic funds transfer, straight through processing, which are very, very much already in action across the banking sector. Why can't we do it in Super? Finally, there, the increase in transparency. We've got to be able to measure what the position is at points in time, so we can monitor how we're going against these goals in terms of improving operational efficiency going forward and reducing costs. We need as an industry to have some mechanism to do that, have an index or something like that where we can check how we're going, keep ourselves honest. Post-retirement incomes, the account-based pension with its minimum and maximum levels around pension was an innovation in itself when it came through. First of all, most people always thought of retirement incomes as, well, you take out an annuity and away you go. So there's a whole lot of core elements like that improve people's lots. You know, control, exposure to growth assets. But there are big risks around volatility, and that risk goes right back to what the member feels. Do they trust that the system is going to look after them? Are they going to find that their retirement income is halved after 2 years just because the market went belly up at that point in time? So these are the very difficult issues that we've been through over the last 2 years, which put these things in focus. The suite of retirement products that are available for retirement are improving all the time, and I think the last year or so has seen great strides with the introduction of the variable annuity type products and the structures around those to Australia from overseas. And it at least gives the market some form of choice around account-based pension versus the annuities, the life annuities, which we know are constrained by various rules that are in place and the perceived lack of value in those. There are opportunities to actually do more on that retirement income side. And I suppose a big question on that is whether the market for larger balances, as some of these products are more applicable to, is very different to the mass market. So how can we improve those in the mass market? So looking at future innovation, they're the challenges. There's a lot of possibilities in the whole product space, remembering that we do need to cater for those with lower balances and as well as those with higher balances. Now, over the next 20 to 30 years, the relative proportions will shift, of course, as the system matures. And the recent increase to 12% of the SGC over a long period of time in the future will also help. So all that helps. There will be a lot more funds in the retirement income space. So we will get to elements of scale, which I think will greatly assist going forward. On the regulatory side, the discouraging of lump sums and the encouragement of incomes, I think, is a very strong one. And it hasn't come out that strongly, really, in the Cooper Review and the Henry Review. There's been some elements of discussion, but not really at that core level. And on the advice side, getting cost-effective advice to all members is very important, and it can be very limited. So I might sum up there. What we've covered really is, firstly, the question of equitable innovation. Now, it must give improved outcomes and be equitable to members. And ultimately, that's a better retirement income and a better lifestyle. And trust in the system and having the system deliver to that trust. Just a caution, past innovation hasn't always been equitable. Think back to actuary funding or initial units, foundation units. Some of you who've worked in life companies 20 years ago, many of us thought that was all very clever, but who was that really helping at the end of the day? Big back end fees. Was the member really getting the benefit, or was it for the shareholders or the agent in those instances? So let's not make those mistakes again. Future innovation is absolutely critical to the industry. We owe it to the members to get those costs down. Cooper sees that very clearly. I think encouraging a lump sum to income thought is critical to get people thinking about incomes in retirement, particularly as the longevity continues to improve. So we've got very, very long periods after retirement. On the operational side, making sure that we do make those small incremental changes, which are simple in administration but hard to make, because it requires the agreement of a whole bunch of different players across the industry. It's hard, but it's basic. And finally, retirement income products is a whole area that does need a lot of work, and we need to be able to offer choice to people and offer members who are approaching retirement a blend of options depending on their position with regard to their account balance and where they are relative to the age pension, which is the ultimate safety net. So thank you for your time, and look forward to taking your questions.
You took one of my pieces of paper. Huh? That's it.
Thanks, Sean. Now, we've got a microphone down the back, so I think I might ask Andrew to lurk around this microphone to answer questions. Just to kick it off, I thought one of the connections that I made from this morning's session, when Frank referred to the reality check of political will to bring a lot of things into force, and it struck me that the couple of things that you're mentioning there require quite a lot of political will and risk-taking, particularly forcing people to take income rather than lump sums. A lot of countries have tried that, and it seems to be remarkably unsuccessful at being. I know the UK is making some changes on that front. And then forcing standardisation in industry for things like data transfer. Who's going to stick their neck out and take the financial services industry on, the superannuation industry on, and say, you must do this? It sounds like a great idea. How do we make it happen so it's palatable? There we are. We'll start there. And please get your questions ready.
Thanks, Meredith. We may have just missed a great opportunity, because indeed perhaps the trade-off to higher contributions over the next 10 years might have been that the industry standardise some of these processes and fall into line. I think there probably is some will. I think, Bowen is quite a strong minister, and I think he's quite serious. And these inquiries that have been set up, albeit that the government's had seemingly inquiries into everything, I think these inquiries do have a theme amongst them and are coming together. And regardless of which major party ends up in power in the next decade, I think there will be a push along these lines. And I think some of it, it's always preferable for, you know, the industries or the participants in an industry to move collectively and have flow-on effects, you know, benefits to consumers by moving in that sort of way. I think if push comes to shove, then there could be some strings attached to some of the benefits that the industry gets from the higher balances and the like. So, I think the political will, there'll probably be some trade-off, but, you know, there's certainly, you just have to look at the reactions to the Henry review. The miners weren't happy, and I think four different industry bodies all lined up in superannuation said, fantastic, just what we needed. You know, IFSA were very happy. I think the industry funds were very happy. I think everyone was happy in the superannuation industry. So,
so they might have overdone it.
Perhaps.
If everyone's happy, then they've gone too far.
Perhaps they have, although I noticed that by the next day a lot of people were talking 15%, not 12%, so maybe they haven't gone far enough. But I think there will be some strings attached along the way if the industry doesn't move first on some of the efficiency measures.
Anybody like to pick up that? Yes, Frank. I've got a mic. I think we're going to have to share this mic. Let me see if I can bend it this way. Probably a better way of doing it.
No.
It is now.
Right. It's not so much the question of standardisation, it's taking up the first point that you made about lump sum to income. And to me, that seems to be one of the areas where the industry has made some movement. But to me, it's the very fact that we call it lump sum is the huge problem. The fact that, oh, you go through life, you reach 65 or whatever it is that you say you retire, and then you get moved out of one fund into another fund. The big innovation that I like is this idea of having a self-managed super fund where you've got a transition to retirement. And really, that transition to retirement, taking up Bernard Salt's ideas, you know, can take 20-odd years. I hope it's going to take 30 years in my case. It's a gradual phase from kicking money into the fund to gradually taking it out. And I think that's the thing that we have to get rid of. This idea that, oh, when I retire, I move money out of this fund into this fund. It gives people the idea, oh, you know, I've got $200,000. Whoopee. If we just get rid of that forced transfer and say, okay, all you've done, you've got your $200,000, you're just not contributing to it now.
So, I mean,
that's a big mental shift, but it's a very important mental shift.
Yeah. Look, what I might do is ask whoever the speaker is to bring the microphone up here, and we'll do a little transfer.
Can people hear me anyway? Yeah.
Just to record it, okay.
Yeah.
All right, so I think there's a sort of realization coming over the superannuation industry at the moment, particularly I'd say on the industry fund side, and I've got a bit more exposure to that side being in Melbourne. They keep taking the retail funds away from Melbourne for some reason. I haven't figured that one out, but the whole question of transition, you look at several industry funds, it's only recently that they're taking those uncertain steps into retirement products other than an account-based pension. And, you know, I was at a retirement conference, post-retirement conference, about a month or two ago, and the room was full of industry members, and very senior industry members too. And I was amazed at sort of the failure of the industry really to realise that this boomer bulge has been coming. It's been coming for 20 years. We, you know, we've known about it for since they were born, I suppose. But the consequences for the industry and the needs around retirement and the fact that that is over, you know, from starting around 50 when people are starting to think about those things all the way forward to 70, 75. You know, at least, for instance, there's recognition of the continuing to work now to 75, for instance, coming out of the reviews. But that process, the penny hadn't really dropped until recently, I would suggest, for a lot of the industry. And it's only now getting the attention that it deserves.
It's perhaps one of the reasons, just picking up on your angle there, Frank, that there's almost there's a line drawn between SMSFs and the rest of the industry, and self-managed funds are treated as the enemy by a lot of the professional part of the industry, if you like. And rather than recognising, to the point you're making, that the idea that you maintain a level of control over your, or design control, if you like, over your retirement savings, regardless of whether you're contributing or not, maybe replicating some of those benefits within funds or trying to have a bit more of an overlap between self-managed funds and industry funds and retail funds, rather than treating their adversaries and all they do is slag each other off. I don't think that's very beneficial for investors, and perhaps that's where innovation needs to be, is self SMSF lookalikes, clones or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that ultimately people will see their superannuation very much the same way as they see their bank account. And, you know, whether they're all in such and such an industry fund or Westpac or CBA with their bank account, it'll be very much quite a personal type experience. And if you sort of picture, you know, you go to your web page and you key in, you spend your hour or two keying in your details and get, you know, for a large mass of people, their financial plan that says, yes, do this, do that, or, you know, and can drop down, a bit like electronic underwriting in the life insurance space, where the rules engines are taking people down. And I think for the masses, that style of financial plan can be achieved. It's probably still a fair way off, but I think it can be achieved. And I think the account balance type position is not much different to that. It's just that at the moment we're sort of, particularly in the retail funds more so, in a product type space rather than in a account type space. And I think the industry fund side of things, it's probably not that hard. And indeed, I think it'll take care of itself to move from that accumulation phase to the pension phase within those funds, subject to technology, in a relatively seamless way. And I think the graph that Sean was referring to, for those that probably haven't seen it, there's a huge bulge of money and people who are approaching that retirement type stage where they will move from accumulation phase to pension phase or drawdown phase. I don't see any real, subject to another GFC, any real reason to say everybody's going to suddenly say, I want to stay in the workforce, I don't want to start drawing down, retire and draw down. I can't see it shifting that dramatically. So I think there'll be that bulge of people will drive that. And I think in the industry funds, I can see that's already underway, but probably not that bigger extension. For some of the retail funds where it's still very much product and advisor-based thing, there still is that, and I think Frank's right on the money, it's still almost a trigger and an encouragement to go, oh, that product's no longer what you are. You need something else and you need some more advice and you need all that sort of thing. And some of that might be true. People probably do need some advice. But it's not a seamless thing, and so it does trigger that in some people's minds. Yep, let's go and spend that $200,000, have a great overseas trip and buy the new car. And then 10 years later, it's gone.
We have a question down here, the gentleman in blue shirt.
Hi, Kerry Hellenius. I was just thinking around this issue of this very issue around self-managed super funds and so on. Are there any stats that show that self-managed super funds have a lower level of double dipping than other funds? And I suspect there is, and I think that's because the self-managed super fund owner or the person who is running that fund is running it with a view to getting an income out of that fund for retirement. And I think that the thing that's missing from the mainstream funds is that there's this big focus on the capital balance, and everyone's focused on the value of the capital. They're not focused on the value of the income that that capital is producing. And even through the global financial crisis, if you actually focused on the income component, it wasn't impacted by 50%. You know, you can manage the income component to have far less volatility than the capital component. So if people were getting information about what that income is each year in terms of their investment portfolio, they could start to focus on the income and target a level of income for retirement out of their investments. So that would give a totally different mindset so that you're not then focusing on the balance and taking that and using it for other purposes.
Yeah, languaging is so important with all of these things, isn't it? Andrew? Sorry, I'll sit down.
Thanks. I think that's a very good point, and maybe instead of showing projected lump sums on superannuation statements, we should be showing projected incomes that could be derived from either the projected lump sum or indeed what's been accumulated to date. So I think that's a very good point. I think on the self-managed fund, on the stats, I think there'd be a natural bias in terms of double-dipping anyway because of the costs involved in setting up your self-managed super fund does drive there's a bias in the individuals that would have self-managed funds versus other funds. So even if those stats existed, it probably wouldn't paint the full picture.
Thanks, Andrew. I think we have a question just here, this gentleman.
Some comments, and then I'm asking you to comment on my comments.
Yes.
I need to declare who I am. I'm Ray Murray, and I work for Sun Super, so I'm actually in one of the few actuaries that's in an industry fund. So that just will help you, Max, understand some of the comments. I would be absolutely opposed to defined benefit guarantee schemes and all that sort of thing emerging. The people who've benefited out of defined benefit have been senior executives. The fact that the pyramid's been cut out from the bottom of them is putting the strain on defined benefit funds, and the company should focus and the executives themselves should focus on that. And I would hate to see the rest of the industry funding defined benefit guarantees. So that's just a comment sitting there. We've had a hard look at the variable annuity stuff as an industry fund, and it is it's very, very difficult to do. We've put it in the too hard basket for the moment, and I think Australian Super's done the same as us. Just a little bit of the understanding of that. We think the products that are there are horrendously complicated. They've got very high margins in them. From our perspective, it's having capital to support them is just about impossible. So, you know, from an industry fund, you don't have the capital base to do it. We see just gigantic legacy issues. You know, so the sort of old endowment insurances and whole of life insurances are going to have nothing compared to the legacy issues that come out of variable annuities. And we were sort of trying to process, and for us as a low-margin provider, if you're a high-margin provider, you can possibly live with the legacy issues. For a low-margin provider, the legacy issues are just, you know, how do you even cope with it? Our own member research told us that at the top end of town, the higher balances weren't interested at all, because they can see that they can adjust their lifestyle. Bottom end weren't interested at all because, in fact, their primary asset is, in fact, the age pension. So it's actually this middle bracket that is sitting there that it is. But because it's an intermediated product, it is going to get missold and it's going to have a whole lot of issues for us. So in terms of innovation, trying to get that retirement space to work correctly is, especially since it's being driven, I often ask myself, is it an American solution looking for an Australian problem? And I suspect it might be. I think lifestyle stage investment is similar to that. So that's my sort of control. I have some other comments to make if nobody else wants to make some.
So I'm interested in your observations.
Be careful of the back of the stage here.
Make sure the back of the stage doesn't collapse under my weight.
Ray, first I might say thank you for your company lending me that slide. Stephen Travis was quite supportive of this. and mentioned you might be around. So thank you. Convey my thanks to him in person. The divine beneficator, I agree that there's a whole lot of other issues around who benefits from those and over a long period of time. Yes, it's all those people that drop out along the way, for instance, are subsidising those that are left because you don't have that portability, etc. But it is rather sad that funds get to that cancer. I think there's probably the whole underlying issue of who's taking the risk and the transfer of risk to the member, very often unbeknownst to the member, is a real one to grapple with. In terms of variable annuity products, I think the cost versus benefit is the key issue there, and they are very complicated. I think, though, that within them, the concept of using derivatives and hedging has actually matured over the last few years. There have been a lot of lessons learned in the States, where a lot of companies had huge losses around them. My understanding is that a lot of that was around failure to actually hedge as strongly as is needed. That identifies some of the risks in those products as well. For those with higher level balances who are looking for that security of income, perhaps in this higher socioeconomic groups where you're looking at very long longevity, then I think they're part they're probably part of the solution. All right.
Just before Frank, I just want to check if anyone else has got a question before we let Frank completely run the session. But I'll come back to you. Thank you. Another question at the back.
Hi, thanks. Andrew Bowell from Towers Watson. Just a comment, I guess, on that last discussion as well. I think one of the things we need to think about is, in the longevity debate, is what level of income people aren't prepared to go down to. So I think, Ray, you mentioned that a lot of people at the low end use the age pension as the fallback position. But we're moving from a position from the last 20 years where the average account balance over that period of time might have been $25,000 to a period over the next 20 years it's going to be more like $250,000, $300,000, $400,000. And so even at the lower income levels, there will be a meaningful amount starting to come through over the next 10 years. And are those retirees going to be happy that if markets move the wrong way and they can't manage their drawdown strategy well enough, that the fallback position is the age pension? Maybe for them the fallback position, rather than being $19,000 a year, is $23,000 a year, and there's room for a product that guarantees that level of income no matter how long they live. And even if that product's not the most efficient, it's probably more efficient than managing that risk themselves. And then, sorry, any thoughts on that as well?
It sounds like a behavioralist sort of answer to some extent there, in that it might be the right thing for them, but can you persuade anyone to do it? Just a question actually to the various practitioners on this is, to what extent is the changing, the Ripple, post-Ripple situation of no commission in terms of the flipping in terms of products? I know it's not yet outlawed for life insurance products, but is there a question there about reviewing or perhaps extending some of those bans on commissions, particularly protecting some of these types of
Again, for us as an industry fund, it's a very interesting question. We've loved commission. Maybe we're far enough away from Melbourne that we've loved it. Because it has allowed a distinction to take place. I think that the My Super stuff is going to have, when we look back at this conference number 10 or whatever, and we look back, 10 years' worth, I think it'll be more dramatic than choice of fund in terms of how it'll change the industry. This is now my personal view rather than a SunSuper view. I think what will happen is the banks will abandon their intermediated products. They'll bring them in-house. I think dealer groups will break up. I think what you'll see is the banks will come back and compete on industry fund turf, which we've had and we've inhabited and enjoyed. I think it'll be the biggest thing that will force consolidation of industry funds, because scale will become all important. I think the MySuper, if it goes through, will have a much bigger change of landscape. And if you go back to the test that you guys set, which is it better for member? Absolutely will be better for members, but it'll force consolidation, and the banks will turn around and say, well, we bought the life insurance companies, we've got all that, and I think you'll see banks buy industry funds. So I think it's going to have such a dramatic change that we're going to be flabbergasted by it.
And that might actually enable a super stream. You know, it's once you get down to a smaller number of concentrate, that's when you can start having some kind of commonality in terms of operations. Next question here, Frank? Or any comments from the gentleman? No. Frank?
Sort of forgot what the question was, but I think it was more a comment on the variability annuities and so forth. My exposure in in Canada was that they were mispriced or missold or mismanaged in general, and I think definitely from the Australian perspective they are a North American product that's looking for a new market. That they've also had incredible problems over in Japan as well. Just as you know, people just didn't manage them properly on the way down, derivatives and all the rest of it, notwithstanding. So I think that I'm much more comfortable in people being able to manage their income stream in retirement, and I think one of the ways in which various industry funds and that are looking for is being easily able to transition people into their individual accounts to and this is sort of coming back to our three questions to fight the SMSF bogey. Industry funds can set up individual accounts internally. And they can be done, or very soon will be able to be done very, very efficiently. And that satisfies the self-managed super fund viewpoint there. And I think that is a way to go for industry funds and also for various retail funds. As long as it's done cheaply enough. Part of what is causing the innovation from the big guys is that there's various little guys around who are starting to innovate in this space because they can cut down the costs, and they can charge fees just a little bit below what the big guys charge and make a fantastic profit on it. And as the big guys cut their fees, they just keep heading down because their cost base is so incredibly small, because they have innovated without having to worry about cannibalisation. And so there's a few small innovators around at the moment who are putting this huge pressure on the big guys.
Can I ask you a general question? I'm interested to see if anyone's got a view on, you know, post-global financial crisis. Is there going to be any reversal back to transferring investment risk back to, you mentioned industry and insurers. Obviously, the whole trend globally over the last 20, 30 years has been about members taking investment risk. Other than longevity risk, which is talked about, I'm not hearing any resurgence of, you know, DB-ish types of structures. Do you think that's ever going to happen? As you mentioned, it was a great defined benefit plans, are great. Is there going to be generation 2 of DB plans? Nope. Yeah, VAs were, but those days are gone. You're on your own. So.
And good, if you've got a 30-year time horizon, you don't need protection.
Peter Beck, I've got a question for Sean. If I heard you correctly, you said SMSFs were leading to, you know, what you call equitable innovation. And you then said, well, they're growing really fast, so therefore there must be something good that they're doing. So my question is, there's two things that drive people. There's kind of emotional triggers, and there's sort of analytic triggers. So I guess my question is, what do you think is, why are SMSFs more equitable? And what's the sort of analytics behind it rather than behavioural? Because I do understand the behavioural around control, and you know, some people like to fiddle with shares when they're in retirement because they've got nothing else to do, and they like doing that. So I understand that sort of behavioural side, but if you look at the pure analytics, is the investment performance better? Is the tax situation better? Is the cost of advice cheaper? You know, is this not something that potentially will be a bit like the, you know, the entry fees or exit fees in the life insurance contracts, where I guess the dreams have been sold, but the reality may not live up to the dreams?
I think you get a lot of variety across the industry. I'm not off the top of my head on top of the relative performance except that I know it's varied according to the period that you look at it. Pre-GFC, there was a lot of angst. Well, there was a lot of discussion in the industry about the fact that SMSF seemed to be, you know, have far too much in cash, for instance, and there was a lot of debate around, well, how accurate were those measurements, because things are measured at 30th of June and a lot of people actually make contributions just before the 30th of June, so they wouldn't have then been invested. So I think it's relatively difficult to actually get those sorts of figures. I think that the main driver of equitable innovation in SMSFs is actually around the fee base, the costs. And again, this depends on what market you're comparing them to, but these generally are relatively high balance situations. They can get economies of scale that are not got elsewhere. I think looking forward, what you find, and I think this is coming back to I think Ray's point there, around the huge change in the marketplace around the banning of commissions and the My Super Space. That is going to focus. That brings in a lot of transparency that wasn't there before, and I think that greatly helps reduce the competitive friction in the marketplace, so that you will get more benefits of scale and lower costs. I mean, an example on the SMSF side is the use of exchange-traded products, for instance, on the stock exchange. And look how they have grown in Australia over the last 4 or 5 years even. An enormous opportunity for those individuals, even with the advice of a financial planner, not to go into even wholesale products elsewhere, and certainly not retail products with their relatively high fees. Yeah, and they can do those things at a relatively low cost. And they can decide on, you know, how much they want to play with their investments by sector or by overseas versus Australia and the like. So I hope that gives some way to answer that.
Thank you, Sean. Sorry, we're going to have to call that to a halt. I know I'm going to go by the bell here. So thank you very much, Sean and Andrew, for your work and then for coming up and across and presenting it. I know everyone appreciates the amount of thinking and research that goes into these sorts of presentations. And thank you for your comments, everybody. I've captured some of those, so they'll reappear at some stage. And please thanks Sean and Andrew for their presentation. Thanks.